This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Bats play a vital role in many ecosystems throughout Ohio, but they're threatened on multiple fronts, including by an infection that attacks when the bats are most vulnerable. Joining me to talk about new research tracking bats in one part of the state and what they've learned about this endangered species are Joe Johnson, an ecologist and an assistant professor of information technology at the University of Cincinnati. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Drew Carson, lead project manager at SWCA Environmental Consultants. Thanks for being here, Drew.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much for having us.
The University of Cincinnati is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. And if you have questions or comments, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Joe, let's start with you. Talk to us about bats and why they're important. Talk to us about the role they play in the ecosystem.
Well, here in Ohio, we have about 10 different species of bats. The number can change. We have some that are very uncommon, so we might have more than that depending on what day of the week you're out there looking. But we have 10, and here in Ohio, they are all insectivorous species. So their role in our ecosystems is primarily that they're insect predators. So they are eating moths, beetles, flies, mosquitoes, you name it. And those species of insects can sometimes be agricultural pests. They can sometimes be disease vectors in the case of mosquitoes and so on. Around the world, bats eat just about everything. There's bats that eat migrating birds. There's bats that eat fish. There's bats that pollinate flowers. So overall, bats are really quite diverse in the roles that they play. But here in Ohio, they're primarily insectivorous.
And Drew, is that something you find you have to explain to people who are maybe kind of freaked out by the thought of bats?
Absolutely. There's a lot of myth out there about bats, right? And so communicating that, you know, they're really helping us out in any number of ways of life, including especially agriculture. You know, bats, there are a lot of estimates about the amount of input they have into agricultural pest control. All of those estimates are in the billions. So that's a whole lot of work that bats are doing for us. And that comes from the offset of pesticide use that farmers would have to have, or just the amount of crop yield, things like that. So absolutely a critical component of our ecosystem across the planet, but also here in Ohio.
Yeah. So Joe, tell us about these this species of bat that you're studying in particular, this little brown bat. They sound adorable. It sounds like they used to be very common, but now they're endangered. Talk to us about that species in particular.
Yeah. First, let me say they are adorable. Bats are beautiful, I like to say. And the little brown bat, as you said, was once one of our most common species. And unfortunately, like a lot of plants and animals around the world, what used to be some of the most common organisms are becoming one of the most rare. The little brown bat is threatened by a fungal disease you alluded to earlier in the program. And what we have today is now only a couple of hundred individuals that we know that live within the state. And one component of my research looks at one of the maternity colonies of the little brown bat. And what a maternity colony is just like it sounds. It's a collection of females in their young of the year that they raise. They typically occupy maybe a tree, or in this case of my research, a building. They huddle together to conserve energy and warmth, and they raise their young. So because the little brown bat has recently been listed as state endangered and it is under review for federal listing, what we want to do is try and get that species downgraded. We don't want it on the endangered species list. We want its populations to be large, robust, and viable over a long period of time. But in order to get there, we need a lot of data. And so what a lot of my research focuses on is trying to get the information that land managers, decision makers need in order to make data-driven responses. So we're looking at tracking their populations. One thing that we do is we put little microchips, RFID tags, under their skin, and we put antennas out on the landscape, and every time a bat flies by one of those antennas, we know when they're there, and this occurs throughout their whole life.
How tricky is that? Because these bats are tiny, aren't they?
Yeah, it can be very tricky, but fortunately, these microchips are quite small. They're similar to what might be on the dashboard of your car for the Easy Pass when you go through the interstate, but these are only about 12 millimeters long, so they're much smaller than a penny in diameter. And we put it underneath their skin. So it's a delicate process. We just lift a small bit of skin up. We take a relatively large needle, but we're all very well-trained professionals, and we put that microchip under their skin. And like I said, this can function throughout the bat's entire life. And because bats can live for several decades, when all goes well anyway, we're getting information on them for the long term, and this helps us generate information like survival, mortality, reproductive rates, and so forth that we need to make decisions about their population status.
I want to talk more about your research, but I also want to talk to you, Drew, because I've seen you quoted as saying, bats are more like people than mice. So can you explain that to me? That really struck me. Talk to us about that.
Sure. Well, perhaps at a genetic scale or phylogenetically, we're more closely related to bats than we are to mice, which are rodents, of course, right? So even though they might be about the same size and shape, we actually probably share more genes with bats than bats do with mice.
So what should that make? How should that make us feel about bats? I mean, or should we be more sympathetic? Should we be friendly? How should we integrate that into our behavior towards bats?
Absolutely. Well, I think we should be sympathetic and friendly with rodents too. but absolutely. I think one thing, the study that Joe's conducting here with this pit tagging is a relatively newer type of study within the bat world. A lot of our ability to study these animals is hindered just by their life history, right? They're extremely small and they're flying around at night. These are scales that humans just don't live on, right? We're diurnal, they're nocturnal. We're walking around, they're flying around. They live in areas that we don't occupy. So our ability to study them is really hindered by that. So we don't know a whole lot about them. When comparing the different species relationships to us and how we interact with them, I think the important takeaway there is that we do have friends on the landscape, and bats are interacting with us in some very important ways.
Yeah. We're talking about bats with Joe Johnson, an ecologist and an assistant professor of information technology at the University of Cincinnati, and Drew Carson, lead project manager at SWCA Environmental Consultants. So, Joe, we were talking about this work you do, these tiny microchips that you and your team implant under the skin of these bats to track them. How tricky was it to even find where they were? I mean, if they're kind of all this maternal group is in this building, how tough was it to figure out where they were heading and hanging out?
Well, for me and my team, it was very hard. But one of the funny things is it was no secret. And so the way that we did this is we conducted what's called a spring migration study. So the little brown bat, like several other species, is a migratory animal. And so right now, they're in their fall migration. They're leaving their summer roosts, and they're meandering their way across the landscape to caves and mines and other places. In the spring, what we did is we leveraged the fact that we knew about several hibernation sites, but we didn't know about any summer maternity sites. So we targeted the period of spring when we know the bats come out of hibernation, right around tax time, and we put up a trap in front of one of those hibernacula. When the bat came out, put a small radio transmitter, just a third of a gram, on the back of the bat, slap it on there with a little bit of glue, and with the help of the Department of Natural Resources, we had an airplane in the sky that tracked this bat all the way from its hibernation site to a building, all the time communicating with us, and we were scrambling around on the ground, driving the roads, trying to get to where the airplane directed us. And it took all night, but we ended up finding the maternity roost.
Wow. So it's just like storm chasers, but bat chasers, kind of.
Yeah, I appreciate that level of drama. It's absolutely, yes.
Okay, very dramatic, very dramatic. So was it, you said it was not a secret, I guess, folks who lived around that building knew the bats were there?
Yeah. So fortunately for us, the building that is the maternity roost is owned by the state, and the people who were working at the building knew that they had bats. They did not know the species. They did not know the rarity or the importance to folks like me. But it's funny because when we walked in and we said, oh, you know, we tracked a bat to this building and we started to give them the story, because you're always nervous. You don't know how this is going to go. And they immediately opened up and they're just like, oh, yeah, we know this and we're excited to learn more about it. It was a very fortunate way that it all played out.
Yeah. Well, we'll continue our conversation about bats in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about bats with Joe Johnson, an ecologist and an assistant professor of information technology at the University of Cincinnati, and Drew Carson, lead project manager at SWCA Environmental Consultants. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. So, Joe, I've noted that you are an assistant professor of information technology. You also know a heck of a lot about bats. Talk to us about how those two interests have intersected.
Yeah. So let me start by saying, unlike what maybe some people think when we talk about information technology, at the University of Cincinnati, we think of information technology as a study of solutions and needs that really connect people, information, and the technology of the time. And so those two areas that I highlighted, solutions and needs, are pretty broad. And we can think about them in a myriad set of ways. And ecology is one of those. So the need, from my perspective, is our biodiversity crisis, that the community that we live within is in peril. And we have a need to address that. And so what I do is I leverage a lot of new techniques in terms of data collection. So these RFID or PIT tags are one, thermal cameras are another, as well as analytical techniques like machine learning in order to answer questions to get at the solutions, or, you know, at least an attempt at a solution, something to address this crisis.
Yeah. So I imagine the people you're working with, do they have a background both in biology and IT, or what does your team look like who's working on this?
Well, my team at the moment includes a couple of graduate students who are in the Department of Biological Sciences here at UC. And so those students are critical to me. They are trained to work in the field. They are experienced animal handlers, and they're getting their degree in the field that they're passionate about. But I also collaborate with students in the School of IT here at Information, or at the University of Cincinnati, and that includes students who are skilled at machine learning, making virtual platforms, the simulation center, and so forth.
Yeah. So, Drew, we alluded to this infection that's dangerous not only to the bats, that this specific species of bats that we've been talking about, but to all kinds of bats. Tell us more about this fungus and what it does and how dangerous it is for bats.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a fungal disease called white nose syndrome. It's caused by the fungus Pseudogymnoascus destructans, which, yeah, what a horrible name
for
a species.
Bad. Right? Yeah.
So it's first discovered in New York in 2006, where they were out doing, you know, annual population censuses at a cave and discovered about 10,000 dead bats outside of that cave. So that's pretty alarming. So since then, it's spread, you know, nearly across the United States, even out to the West Coast. Basically, what happens is this fungus will infect bats at their most vulnerable time of year while they're hibernating, get into their skin and kind of eat their skin from the inside out, forcing bats to arouse from hibernation, which can spark an immune reaction that just destroys their skin functionally. Mm-hmm. So usually you might survive the first winter, but by about the third winter, you're probably not going to make it through. It does affect some bats more than others, like you'd mentioned. So we have our cave hibernating bats. Those are the ones that are really susceptible. And even within that group of bats, there are some that aren't as affected. The little brown bat, unfortunately, the species that Joe is studying, is one that has been heavily affected. They were once one of the more common bats in the landscape, and we barely see them anymore, really, depending on where we are.
And is it true? I thought I read that this white nose syndrome is the first known pathogen that kills during hibernation. Is that a distinguishing feature of this white nose syndrome?
That's a tough one. You know, it is one of the more insidious, probably, just in that it's, like I said, eating their skin from the inside out while they're asleep. Well, one of the reasons you hibernate is, as an insectivore, there just aren't bugs in the landscape available for you during the winter, right? So you have to shut down your metabolism because there's nothing for you to eat. While your metabolism is shut down, therefore your immune system is shut down as well. So it's a really just the worst time of year. What happens is you'll have a cave full of, you know, tens of thousands of bats sharing white nose among themselves, and they'll take their spores from their cave or their mine where they spend the winter and fly to their maternity colony, which might have members of, you know, a different cave or mine. And so you spread those spores. So white nose has been able to make jumps of hundreds of miles in a given year across these bats' landscape.
Joe, it sounds like it's especially, I mean, I guess it's horrible in all cases, but especially in these maternity colonies. Have you all been able to observe this, or have you seen it in the colony that you're studying?
Well, when we follow bats as they leave their hibernation site, we might see some signs of it. And for the first couple of weeks of spring, while bats are recovering, we see some signs of it. But the thing about white nose syndrome is that it's going to be manifesting itself the most during winter. So typically when bats are out on their summer landscape and reproducing, they will heal within the first couple of weeks. And so the last couple of months have been the good times for them, and they're about to re-enter, unfortunately, the very challenging time again.
You mentioned that the goal is to help these bats get off the endangered species list and help them, you know, try to have more of these bats around. What can we do? What can, you know, regular people do who aren't, you know, bat experts and we don't have the chips to implant on bats and study them the way you're doing? What can all of us do to help?
Yeah. One of the things that really excites me about working in bat conservation is that we are dealing in some cases, and in the case of the little brown bat, with a species that can survive in a urban, suburban environment, as well as a relatively wild, quote-unquote, pristine environment. As many of us know, they can live in our barns, they can live in our attics, and so forth. And so that provides, from my perspective, an opportunity to work with them. So when people ask me what they can do, one of the first things that I say is, if you have bats in your building, in your barn, and that's a problem, there's a way to deal with that, and you should reach out to your Department of Wildlife or Department of Natural Resources, and there are folks there who can work with you to make sure that your space is separate from their space in a way that respects everybody's ability to thrive, including the bats. So that's one. Another thing is bats need forests, right? These bats, like we talked about before, are living off of the insect populations. They're drinking water. They're living in that forested environment that surrounds many of our homes. And forest management is really integral for them. Those natural spaces are really important for them to survive in when they're out on the landscape at night, eating and hunting for bugs.
Drew, are there things that we as people are doing that are messing with the bats inadvertently? And I'm thinking we had a program earlier last week that talked about the insect crisis and how leaving lights on at night can be a mess for insects and can really confuse them. I wonder if are there things like that that people are doing that are really creating challenges for the bats that were the challenges that we don't mean to create?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think touching on what Joe was saying about maintaining forest habitat, there are a decent handful of species that roost in dead and dying trees. And so whereas you might want to cut that tree down for firewood or whatever it might be, if you're in a position where that tree is not affecting the safety of people, you know, on your property, then consider leaving that up. That might be a good place for a bat to roost. Pesticide use in lawns, right, and planting non-native species. If there's an area of your property that you don't need to mow, maybe leave it. That could be a great place for insect biodiversity that creates, a foraging habitat for bats.
We do have an email from Lauren. Lauren writes, "We have noticed in years past when our neighbors used mosquito control companies, we don't have bats at night. In all years prior to the treatment, we'd been lucky to have quite a few. Has there been any study of the correlation to low bats when this pest control stuff is used?" She said, "By the way, this year our neighbors chose not to hire a company and our bats are back." Have either of you seen any studies on that kind of correlation?
Well, I'm not aware of any studies, but it certainly is a logical step to take. You know, if the pesticides they're using aren't selective to mosquitoes, then it probably reduces at a broad spectrum the foraging ability of bats in that area.
Yeah. Joe's giving you a thumbs up, so that is agreeing with that answer. So, Joe, you were talking about these buildings where these bats can exist. Does that mean that we should maybe consider coexisting peacefully with bats rather than freaking out if we find them in our attics?
That's a complicated question for me personally. Mm-hmm. I would love to have bats in my barn. I look out there frequently, hoping every time, and they're currently not there. And that level of cohabitation in my barn would be right for me. And I'm not going to say that that's right for everybody, but I agree that there is a level that works for us. And they make me happier. They make my children happier because there's fewer insects that bite them at night. And so it's great. I would caution against maybe them in your living room or them in your bedroom. And I don't think bat biologists or conservationists are advocating that. But there is a happy medium between too close to nature and too far away. And I think that we can all achieve that on our properties, those of us who are living in a somewhat natural space.
Yeah, and that's where I guess we need to contact our experts if we run into them and figure out how to manage them correctly.
Absolutely.
I've been talking with Joe Johnson, an ecologist and assistant professor of information technology at the University of Cincinnati, and Drew Carson, lead project manager at SWCA Environmental Consultants. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thanks
for having us.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Assistant producer is Nick Swartzell. Technical director is Derek Smith. Our theme music was composed by Rob Fetters. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.